the more important thing, rather than trying to cover a huge area, was to go deeper in a smaller area. Deeper in terms of market knowledge, deeper in terms of relationships, deeper in terms of resources, connections, all those kind of things. So we actually now focus solely on the Southeast US. So Georgia, North Florida, Carolinas, and very select parts of Eastern Tennessee and Alabama. It's nothing wrong with all those other places. We just found that instead of trying to go a mile wide and an inch deep, we try to go really deep in a smaller area. And that's actually led to greater success for us for all of those reasons.
Welcome to the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing podcast, brought to you by Blue Oak Capital. If you are looking to take your real estate investing to the next level and learn how you can achieve your financial success by investing in multifamily real estate, then this show is for you. Our mission is to help you improve your education and learn proven strategies from industry leaders to help you master multifamily investing. Now here's your hosts, Cody Laughlin, John Beatty, and Brian Alfaro.
What's up, guys? Real Estate Cody here, inviting you to join our Preferred Investors Club. Now, what is the Preferred Investors Club? That is an exclusive list of investors that get early priority access to all of our investment offerings before it goes out to our general database. Now, why is that important? I'll tell you. Because our last two investment offerings oversubscribed by several million dollars each, and each had a waiting list. So if you want to get in and you want to make sure that you don't miss out on any of the offerings that we're putting out there, make sure to get on this list. So if you want early access, get in now. Go to www.blueoakinvest.com/investor-form. Drop your contact information in there so we can get you added onto that list so you can get your priority access. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Now to the show. Good morning, everyone. Real Estate Cody here, and I want to welcome you to another great episode of the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing Podcast. With me, as always, in the co-pilot seat, Mr. Brian Alfaro, the coffee connoisseur. What's up, buddy?
Real Estate Cody, nice to see you again.
Always great to see you, bud. Always great to see you. Another great episode lined up today, so looking forward to getting in that conversation. But hey, before we get started, you know, we're kind of thinking about last week's episode. We had a great conversation with our prior guest talking about various things about educating and passive investors in the space, right? And we've been talking a lot about kind of investor sentiment right now with all the changes in the market. What are your thoughts right now on what some of the conversations we're having?
I think the conversations we're having, especially with the more experienced operators, is that people are still finding creative ways to do deals. Things are pivoting. Things are moving. The recipe that you used to sort of bake that cake even 6 months ago or 12 months ago, especially, you know, 2-3 years ago, is much different than it is today. But there's still a way to go out there, get things done, invest in real estate. You know, we keep sending the message and we're hearing it, right? It's not timing the market. It's about time in the market. So as long as you're sticking to your investing thesis, finding good operators, finding good projects, there's still a lot of good opportunity out there. You just got to make sure you're staying educated and staying active.
Yeah, well said, buddy. Well said. I think it's still a phenomenal time to buy. You just got to learn and adjust with the market, which I think is going to be a great segue into our great guest we have on today. So tell us who that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Today, we welcome Andrew Cushman to the show. Andrew is with Vantage Point Acquisitions. He's a former chemical engineer who found his entrepreneurial calling in real estate. In 2007, Andrew left his corporate position to start a business in real estate investment, starting off flipping single-family properties in Southern California. Sensing a shift in the market, in 2011, Andrew transitioned to multifamily acquisitions and has successfully syndicated and repositioned over 2,300 multifamily units. He's a frequent guest and panelist on real estate podcasts and educational forums, and recently launched the Multifamily Accelerator, a multifamily mastermind group for active and experienced real estate investors. Outside of the business world, Andrew is a certified alpine ski instructor, and when not working in real estate, enjoys surfing, backcountry skiing, and trying not to be outwitted by his two young children. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be here.
Andrew, that has to be one of the best intros I've ever heard. Not be outwitted by your two younger ones. That's a bigger challenge than multifamily syndication, I'll tell you.
I say that's an ongoing battle right there.
Well, hey, man, we appreciate you being on the show today, man. Looking forward to learning more about you and Vantage Point Acquisitions, but kind of give us a little bit more context into your background and kind of how you found yourself here today.
Yeah, well, I mean, like Brian just mentioned, used to be a chemical engineer, but that was just a placeholder. Even in high school, I knew I wanted to do my own thing. I just didn't know what that looked like or how. So I became an engineer, so I knew I would at least have a good job. And after 7.5 years of being an engineer, along the way, I got married. And then my wife and I discovered real estate, flipping houses specifically here in Southern California. This was just before, this was 2007, just before the crash, and flipped a condo and made as much as I made all year working at my engineering job. So we said, all right, this is it. So I walked in and quit my job right as the financial crisis hit, which everyone thought was nuts, but actually turned out great because we had no competition for buying real estate, and we'd buy it at 50 cents on the dollar and turn it around and sell it for 80 cents on the dollar, and had a great run. But after about 4 years of that, we said, you know, this is fantastic, but it's just another job. What can we do that, number one, what is the next big thing that's going to benefit from our, you know, changing economic cycles? And then what builds lasting income and wealth? And so we figured, hey, everyone either just got foreclosed on and can't buy a house, or they know someone who got foreclosed on and they're scared to buy a house. That means everyone's going to be renting for the next 7 to 10 years. And then add that together with, well, we just had a big recession, so we're probably going to have a long expansion, which means job creation, income going up. Okay, so that probably means rentals are going to do really well. So yeah, 2010, I went and actually found a guy who had done about 800 units, hired him as a mentor. Our first deal was 92 mostly vacant units on the other side of the country. I don't recommend doing it that way. And we've been full-time in apartments ever since. And actually, we're up to about 2,700 units now. So.
And love it, love it, love it. It's exciting. That's good stuff. And a way to capitalize on the opportunity. I mean, we were just talking about this as we were doing our intro in the show, right? Where everybody's getting spooked right now with the market. Oh, our interest rates are rising to the moon and things are going to collapse and equities are getting pounded. And everybody's got this fear that the bottom is about to fall out of the market. But you got to look through all that cloudiness and see that, man, you know, there's still a prime time opportunity. So, you know, hearing stories like yours is just reassurance that, you know, you could always be a buyer and investor in market cycles, no matter whether up or down. You just got to understand what's going on with that market. So really inspiring story, man. Appreciate that. So 2,700 units, that's man, that's an impressive feat. That's a big portfolio. Talk to us a little bit more about the markets that you're diversified in and where you guys are investing your efforts and time.
Yeah, so we've actually, and I should be clear, we don't currently control 2,700. That's just the total over the last 11 years. We have sold off some of that, but we've actually done kind of the reverse of what you alluded to, in that we used to have stuff in Texas and Georgia and Florida. And what we found is we were actually too spread out. Back in 2011 or in 12 and 13, multifamily deals, or really real estate deals of almost any kind, were everywhere. It was just like, you know, walking to the beach and trying to find a shell. It usually takes you about 23 seconds and there, oh, there's one. Oh, here's another one over here. And that's, you know, I used to look at deals and line them all up and say, okay, I'm going to come out in 3 weeks and we're going to look at these properties. And you could do that right now. If a great property shows up, it may have an offer in less than 24 hours. You know, so it's a completely different environment. And so, like I said, we had stuff in Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, Atlanta, North Florida. And as the market got more competitive, what we realized is the more important thing, rather than trying to cover a huge area, was to go deeper in a smaller area. Deeper in terms of market knowledge, deeper in terms of relationships, deeper in terms of resources, connections, all those kind of things. So we actually, several years ago, sold off everything we had in Texas. And we now focus solely on the Southeast US. So Georgia, North Florida, Carolinas, and very select parts of Eastern Tennessee and Alabama. And that's actually led to greater success for us for all of those reasons. Nothing wrong with those Texas market or all those other places. We just found that success is instead of trying to go a mile wide and an inch deep, we try to go really deep in a smaller area.
We appreciate that because, you know, we're based here in Texas, so you got to leave more for us here. So
you've got enough competition there without me, so you're good.
Yeah. Well, it brings up such a great point, and I really appreciate you alluding to this because, Brian, we see this, I don't want to call it mistake, but we see this happening all the time to people entering the space, right? They want deal flow. They want a wide deal funnel. And so they start overextending themselves into multiple markets. And what you find is you really never gain any traction, right? Yeah, you may have a deal here and there, but you really never become an expert at one market. And so you really never develop that system and that scalability because you're spread too thin, unless you have a wide, you know, a large team. But I would argue most people don't have that support team around them to do that. So it definitely does make it more challenging. I don't know, Brian, any thoughts?
The relationships are really the key piece here that people take for granted. I mean, you find deals, so to speak, to use that term, in any market if you're really looking hard enough. But where the deals really come from in today's market cycle are from relationships, getting early access to things, building relationships with brokers, talking to property managers, and if you're spreading yourself too thin and looking at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 markets because you're getting shiny object syndrome and you saw somebody close a good deal in one other market, you're never building those strong relationships. So you never really crack the surface, so to speak. So I agree with everything Andrew's saying. You're saying, Cody, you really got to pick one, maybe, you know, two really prime areas. You know, it can be a few different cities in that area, but really dial in your investing thesis. What markets are you focusing on? And as we've been speaking, you know, go inch wide, mile deep versus the other way around.
Yeah. And look, it takes some discipline, mm-hmm. right? It takes discipline and patience, because if you're isolating yourself just to a select, you know, market, two markets, whatever it is, or region, like you guys are in, Andrew, I mean, it takes discipline to kind of be patient enough when, hey, deal flow is plentiful or deal flow starts to, you know, wane a little bit or whatever the case may be. But it's very easy to get the shiny object syndrome and you want to go to the next best market or the next best thing, when in reality, you got to just got to grind it out, man. You just got to be laser focused. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And Brian did a really good job of summarizing the most important thing, and that is those relationships, right? I don't think we've purchased something that was listed since 2015 or 16. I mean, it's been, you know, 6, 7 years, maybe even longer, but since we bought something that's on the market. Everything we buy is a relationship with a broker who something, a property comes up or an owner says, you know what, I might entertain selling. And they're like, oh, okay, this one's perfect for Vantage Point. I'm going to call Andrew. No one else ever sees it, right? So it's those relationships. But also, when you focus on a certain region or market, you get to know that market so well that it enables you to move, not only move quickly, but with more confidence, right? I mean, there's not many submarkets in Georgia, for example, that we, you know, and of course, we're going to go through and verify and do our due diligence before we actually buy anything. But there's not many properties or submarkets in Georgia that you could send us and we don't already know what the median income is, how the crime is it growing, is it declining, and is this an area that we want to buy in or not buy in, right? And so that's one of the benefits of really diving into a market and getting to know it, is not only the relationships to bring you the deals, but it makes you that much more efficient at processing them and being able to make decisions and getting in an offer. I mean, we closed a deal in March where a broker was having breakfast with our acquisitions person, and a seller that he had a long-term relationship with, or an owner, not a seller, happened to call him and said, hey, I just want to let you know, I'm about to sign this offer these guys gave me. I think I'm going to go ahead and sell. And that broker said, hold on a minute. I think I might be able to do you just a little bit better than that. Texted us. I was there within an hour, met with the seller, and then, you know, longer story short, we closed on that deal in March, right? And that was like almost a 200 unit deal. Part of the way we were able to do that was, number one, like the most important thing that Brian summed up really well was the relationship. And number two, we knew that market inside and out already. So it wasn't a question of, well, okay, and how is this area? Do we want to own here? Like the minute we had the address, we're like, yep, that's a good spot. We know that. Done. And yes, we did verify everything and we never cut corners, but it allows you just to move that quickly so that within 24 hours, the guy had an offer from us and he had met us in person and we ended up getting the deal. And our offer was not higher, by the way.
That is such a great, great point. I mean, we just had a recent revelation with that as well. You know, we have an asset here in a local submarket in Houston, and coincidentally, the neighboring property popped up on a broker list and immediately was on site doing a tour, had an offer an hour after the tour. But to your point, because we knew the market, we knew the demographic, we were already operating in the market. So it just gives you that scalability and that confidence, like you said, just to really execute that, which gives you a competitive advantage. So really, really important point to emphasize there. Really appreciate you bringing that up. But listen, when it comes to the relationships, it didn't start there, right? It just didn't start overnight and just with one phone call and say, hey, give me all your off-market leads.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. So talk to us about that relationship building process, and how did you go from having to buy market rate deals, I'm assuming, to now you're just sourcing off-market deals, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, these days, you know, if let's just say I was going to go to a completely new market and start over, how we would go about developing those relationships in that market is, and you're absolutely right, Cody, you don't just, and candidly, this is a great way to irritate people, is to call them up and act entitled and be like, hey, send me all your good off-market stuff, right? I mean, that's like, well, who are you to, you know, ask me for that? So if we were going to a new market, what I would do is, number one, go to all the big brokerage websites like Berkadia's website, Marcus & Millichap, Cushman & Wakefield, you know, And actually, even more so, the regional brokers, right? There's brokers that specialize in certain states or region, and just see like who are the brokers and who has the listings, and then sign up to get on their email, on their mailing lists. And then when you start getting those email updates on properties, take a look at it. Even if those properties that you're getting, those deals, aren't necessarily a good fit, that's the conversation starter, right? Analyze that deal, call the broker and ask them questions about it. You know, use those deals to build a relationship. And if you do that for long enough, number one, you're going to form a relationship. Number two, you're going to show them that you're not Mr. Shiny Object who just, oh, my friend just said, I got a great deal in Salt Lake City. So now I'm going to look at Salt Lake City. And then 6 months later, oh, this market's too hard. I'm going somewhere else, right? So you show that, number one, you persist. You really are putting in the time and the effort. Number two, you're not entitled, right? Whether it's listed or off market, the broker's number one goal is to get the property sold, right? Because that's how they serve their client, the owner, and that's how they get paid. So you're still helping them by looking at those deals. And third thing is you're, in a sense, training them on what you're looking for, right? They send you a deal and you look at it and you call them and say, hey, I really appreciate you sending me this. Looks like it's a great asset, but it's not quite a fit for us because, you know, three buildings are in a flood zone, or it's a, you know, a tax credit deal, or whatever the reason may be, concrete, specific, actual reasons. And that shows that you're real. And again, it helps them to learn what you're looking for. So when that perfect deal does come across, they think, oh, Cody, this is that guy I got to call.
Yeah, you know, Andrew, we talk about this a lot, but I'm the director of acquisitions on our team. And I get asked this often, well, how are you building relationships with brokers? And, you know, do you take them out to lunch? Do you take them out golfing? And I'm like, that's the last thing you should be worried about, because number one, they're very busy professionals, right? Their time is very valuable, but people discredit the importance of building that relationship through feedback, which you just mentioned, like actually looking at deals, actually analyzing deals, giving constructive feedback, showing up on the tours. Like that's where the relationship is built. And then, yeah, you close a deal and everybody's celebrating and then you want to go out for golf or whatever. Like that's the time to do it. But any and everybody can take somebody out for a cup of coffee or dinner and try to smooth somebody. But if you're not out there being active, visible in the market and giving that concrete feedback, you're just another guy. I mean, just be honest.
Yeah. Well, and also it's the small things, because you know, you've heard it said many times before, but you do everything the way you do little things, right? So if your broker sends you something, you say, hey, I'll get back to you on Wednesday, get back to them on Wednesday. Even if life threw you a curveball and you didn't get a chance to look at the deal on Wednesday, say, oh, hey, I'm really sorry. Wasn't able to look at this, but I just wanted to let you know I'm still interested. I'll talk to you tomorrow, right? Just a little bit to follow up. And then the biggest thing is when the answer is no, tell them no. Don't ghost them and, oh, well, this property sucks. Forget it. Delete. Give them the feedback. Hey, thank, like I said before, thanks for sending this. Here's why it's not a good fit. The other thing too is, and I almost hate to use this word because it's so overused and almost cliche now, but be authentic in the relationships. And what that means is you're not gonna be best friends with all 27 brokers in Dallas or whatever it is, right? There's gonna be certain people that you just connect better with and just naturally, and focus on those relationships. Number one, it's more effective. Two, it's more fun and more enjoyable. Life's too short to be doing stuff you hate or working with people that you don't like to work with, right? That's part of the problem. That's one of the reasons people get into this business. Like, oh, I couldn't work in a corporate environment. I had to build my own thing. So even after 11 years, there's lots of brokers in Atlanta that, you know what, I don't really talk to that much or don't have a great relationship with. That's okay. I can't be friends with everybody, but we do have great longstanding relationships with the ones that, for whatever reason, we really connect well, and that works.
Andrew, I have a hard time finding you can't be friends with everybody. I mean, you're from Southern California. You got a surfboard in your background. I mean, come on, man. You just got a good vibe. Come on.
Well, I got that. I appreciate that.
No, man. But I agree with you. I think that's a great point as well. I mean, you know, it's this entire industry, everything that we do involves people and it involves relationships. And you're not going to connect with every single person. There's just no way. You know, you just have to, like you said, leverage those good relationships that you do have and lean in on those heavily. So great points there. Well, Andrew, I want to kind of pull back. I want to shift gears a little bit. We've been talking about acquisitions and broker relationships for a little bit, but I actually want to go back and talk about strategies for you guys right now in this market cycle. You mentioned you started in the Great Recession. I'd imagine you learned a ton going through that market cycle. We've had a couple little small recessions or pullbacks, I guess, economically over the last couple of years. And then now we find ourselves in this hot mess that we're in with the interest rate environment, Fed policy, all the things that are going on right now. Is your strategy changing at all? Or are you guys doing anything differently in your approach right now in this market cycle versus what you've done in the past?
We are. Yes, definitely. I certainly do not believe we are headed for a real estate crash. The fundamentals are just way too strong in, you know, in support of real estate. And then if you add on inflation on top of that is actually supportive of real estate pricing and values. And we also demand far outstrips supply, especially in residential real estate, like, you know, rentals and apartments. So big picture fundamentals, very, very strong. Also, you know, the great financial crisis of 2008 was largely perpetrated by extremely loose and irresponsible lending. We do not have that this time around, either in the single family or in commercial. Now, with all of that said, it's not risk-free. To me, the biggest risk for multifamily going forward is on the debt side. And that is if rates dramatically move higher and stay there, then what can happen is, I think in 2021, 70% of all multifamily acquisitions were done with bridge loans, which means that loan has to be refinanced usually 2 to 3 years from when it was originated. And you might be able to get an extension, but what most people realize is that's not a guaranteed thing. You have to qualify for that extension. And if interest rates are too high in the near future, when those loans come due, there might not be enough of a debt coverage ratio, meaning there might not be enough cash flow to cover the debt to a ratio that's acceptable to the lender. And so those loans may not be able to be refinanced. And now all of a sudden, if you're in that situation, you could have a problem. You might be forced to sell at an opportune time or forced to sell and not make a profit or potentially even lose some equity, or you might be doing a capital call to make up the difference. So again, operationally, I'm expecting multifamily to continue to do well, especially if you're taking a longer term view. It's pretty tough for me to imagine a well-located, well-operated apartment building is going to be worth less 5, 7, or 10 years down the road than it is today. So it's all about staying power and just being able to hold on to it, even if we do get into a rougher patch in the next few years. So the key to mitigating that risk is structuring your debt properly. So what we've been doing on our last, I think, 4 acquisitions is we've actually gone in at 60 to 65% loan to value instead of 75, and we've never done 80, simply because we see that as the biggest way to mitigate that risk. If you're only at 60 or 65% loan to value on your loan going in, if, you know, 2 years from now, interest rates are a lot higher, it's a tough market, then, okay, fine, we'll just hold on and continue to wait. But even if interest rates are higher, we can still refinance because we only started off at 6 or 60 or 65% to begin with, right? You know, if you start at 80% in order to refinance, you have to be significantly higher, especially if you're trying to transition to agency. And then let's say, hey, 2 to 3 years from now, things are actually fine. Maybe interest rates are a little higher and we hit some bumps, but we're still cruising along. Well, great. You can refinance, get a supplemental, pull that cash out, sell or hold. It's going in with lower leverage so that we have basically the ability to adapt to whatever market environment happens to show up 2 to 3 years from now. I think that is the key to being able to continually and confidently buy in this market, is just making sure that you've mitigated for what those potential risks are.
Sound familiar, yeah. Cody?
I was going to ask you, Brian, like, don't you hear a recurring theme here? I mean, listen, I think this is such an important point because when you talk about hedging our positions and really baking in a lot of contingencies to weather any of these downturns, I mean, you're right, man. The past several years, everybody's been maxing leverage at 80%, you know, 75%, and you've been getting these amazing aggressive terms on your bridge debt, and it's been great. But look how fast the market has done a 180 just in the past 8 weeks, and how much that can impact your business right now, you know, immediately. And to your point, I mean, most of the bridge debts, all of the bridge debts that I know of, are all on variable rate. So, you know, when we acquired our deal, Brian, you know, our interest rate was like all in at 3.75. You know, now we're already above 4.5, and it's only going to keep going up. So thank God for a rate cap. but the point is, I mean, just that short period of time, everything has shifted so dramatically. And so it does make you worry. And one of the best ways to bulletproof your deal, as we like to call it, is looking at your leverage and make sure that you have the right debt in place. So That's so critical. And look, not just from an active investor side, not just from us who are actually acquiring deals, but from a passive investor perspective as well, this is really important. Like when you look at kind of looking at your risk mitigation and looking at an investment opportunity and, hey, how well is this deal protected? When you've got a deal that's at 60% leverage, you can weather a lot of storms with that. I don't know. You have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's a mistake that both sponsors and passive investors make, right? A lot of sponsors just feel like they have to put out the highest pro forma IRR they can get the spreadsheet to conjure up, right? And so that's, well, okay, we can, they'll give us 80%. Great. Oh, wow. We can get to 85. We'll take it, right? Just so that IRR number that the spreadsheet spits out is higher. Number one, you don't have to do that. I think, you know, smarter investors are able to realize that there's an element of financial engineering there. And that just because a spreadsheet spits out a number, actually making that happen in real life is an entirely different endeavor. And then on the flip side, there's a temptation when you're an LP investor, just, you know, take the five offerings that you got this week, lay them out on your screen and be like, all right, well, this one has the highest IRR. I'm going to do that, right? Well, what kind of risks are involved in trying to achieve the IRR? What kind of execution risk is there? How highly levered is that? You know, is that IRR based on, you know, an 80% bridge loan with a 10% mezzanine piece on top of that? So it's actually 90%, you know, levered up just to try to get that 18 or 20 or 21? Or is the 13.5 IRR, which might not sound sexy compared to those other two, is that the better deal because it's extremely lower levered? It's a high quality asset in a growing market. It's all about risk adjusted. And I see that that's a common mistake on both sides, is the more inexperienced LP investors just looking for the highest IRR on the pro forma. And then the sponsors feeling like they have to financially engineer something to get to this crazy number that they have a low chance of hitting, or just that everything has to go right for that number to be hit. And it has the last 5 or 6 years, but eventually that's going to stop. And as a sponsor, you want to set yourself up to hopefully beat expectations, not set yourself up to miss them down the road. So yeah, there's two sides of that piece.
Yeah. And look, great point too. I mean, that's been the downside of what we've seen over the last decade, is people have been achieving amazing returns in short hold periods, 2-3 years, and they're getting 2-3x multiples and everybody's happy, right? And it's been wonderful. But the problem is that's not really normal application, right? When you look at like a normal, what I would call a normal cycle, I guess, where typically you have to hold these things 5-7 years, you have to be lower levered, you know, to really benefit from having assets like this, having this as part of your portfolio. So I think people have lived in this fantasy land over the last couple of years because the market has been so hot. And I think it will continue to be a great market. I think it's still a phenomenal time to invest, but the tides are turning a little bit, where we need to get back to more ground-rooted fundamentals when it comes to investing. You know, and Brian, I know we talk about this all the time, right? Where expectations need to be reset, where you can't sit back and expect those 2-3x multiples or those 20% IRs in 2-3 years anymore. We need to get back to, hey, taking the long-term approach, 5-7 years, you know, 13-15% IR. Hey, at the end of the day, that's still a great return. You know, I don't know. What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, I want to encourage all of our listeners, especially if you're a passive investor, to rewind, go back, you know, whatever, the 60 seconds or so. When Andrew started talking about this, this is such a golden nugget for people to understand, is you really need to understand your investing thesis and your risk tolerance. It's not about the, you know, which one has the highest number, which one has the most attractive AAR, IR. Really dive deep into these business plans. Ask really intelligent questions about the leverage. Ask about the sponsor's business plan. Ask if the deal is stress tested, if it is on bridge debt, on, you know, is there an interest rate cap? There's a lot of questions you really need to understand, not just looking at the, you know, the prettiest girl at the dance, so to speak. So I think that's a phenomenal nugget that people really need to dive deep into and really understand, like I said, their risk tolerance and what they're getting into for the next 3-5 years. Because if you get something and you invest in something that has those shiny numbers, but it's not a realistic expectation or it's over levered, and you could really get into some trouble. And, you know, that's a bad day. At the end of the day, you don't want to make your first or second passive investment and have that bad taste in your mouth just because you chased the higher number.
Well, and look, the reality is too, is I think syndicators, we've kind of been forced in a way to some degree to kind of go with that higher leverage, you know, especially if you're a younger shop, right? If we're competing against you, for example, Andrew, right? Hey, the only way that I'm going to give myself a fighting chance is I've got to get to Whisper. I've got to get to 75, 80% loan to value, loan to cost, because if I don't have that leverage, then my returns don't look as attractive, right? So I can't go in with that lower purchase price on my offer because of the competition. But because the tides have now turned and because of the cost of capital and the capital markets impacting our businesses, you're now seeing more fluidity in negotiations between buyer and seller, right? So now the doors are open again to have more of those fluid conversations and saying, hey, look, we can now go in at a lower leverage, lower purchase price than what the seller was hoping for, but we can make sure that this transaction will still go smoothly and everybody's happy at the end of the day. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And that is going to be, you know, one of the conversations with sellers, and sellers may have to adjust expectations a little bit as rates and the cost of debt continue to rise. That's one of the reasons that sponsors, like you were saying, have been, in a sense, trained to push the leverage as high as they can over the last few years is to compete, right? Well, okay, if I can get to 80%, then I can get that price a little bit higher and win the deal. And sometimes that's true. But what you really want to try to do nowadays is shift more to, instead of competing on price, competing on execution, right? Okay, maybe this other buyer is going to offer you $100,000 more, but they're doing it at 80% leverage. And if interest rates move, is that deal going to blow up, right? Whereas, hey, I'm $100,000 lower, but I'm at 65%. And if interest rates move, I can adjust and accommodate that. Not a problem, right? So this your lower offer has a higher certainty of closing. And so it's like I said, you know, most of the deals that we've gotten lately, well, they're all off market, but that there's still usually another buyer or two in the mix. And we're usually not the highest price. We're winning on terms of, you know, like certainty and deposits and some of those other things. And then kind of looping back to what we were talking about earlier, that's another reason a lot of sponsors don't like to go lower leverage, because it does lower the returns. It lowers the cash on cash. It lowers the IRR, but there's a trade-off there. It's risk adjusted. So yeah, so those are some of the adjustments there.
Yeah, to your point about the seller expectations and those conversations, especially when you get to the seller interview, for example, you know, before you're getting awarded the deal. I mean, yeah, that's the conversation piece. It's, hey, purchase price, we're taking a haircut. They know it. I mean, most of the sellers on today's market, they're also buyers. They understand the capital markets and the dynamics there, but it's the ability to execute. I want surety of close. And that's where you really got to put the emphasis on and the focus on is as you mentioned, what are the terms and how can we make sure that we establish our credibility in being able to execute this transaction and get it to close? Because we are hearing this consistently. You're hearing deals that are falling out, whether it's already going under contract or maybe in negotiations, but deals that are falling out completely. A lot of retrading is going on, which has always been the negative word. But I mean, the reality is that's what's happening, right? You're getting under contract, the markets move again, and you know, you can no longer pencil the deal. And so we're seeing a lot of those opportunities as well.
Yeah, and I think we should probably briefly address one thing that's as yet unspoken, that's probably in the back of everyone's mind listening to us discuss this. I don't think this is going to lead to, a crash or widespread price declines, because there's no operational distress, right? With the possible exception of some people who took bad bridge loans, no one needs to sell right now. In fact, we have the opposite problem. Almost every owner we talk to says a combination of, well, I'm making so much money off of this thing that my life is great. And number two, if I did sell it, I don't know what to do with the money and I don't have anywhere else to put it. So I just don't want to sell. So, you know, yeah, a deal may fall out or it might retrade or a buyer might offer less. But in many situations, the sellers just say, okay, cool, I'm going to hang on, right? So there's not this huge motivation to sell. So where the seller, all right, fine, I'll cut $3 million off the price. You know, that'll happen here and there, but widespread, I'd be surprised if we got to that.
Completely agree with you. Completely agree with you. Look, I think people are just benefiting from the timing of the market and the accelerated appreciation that we've seen over the last 24, 36 months. I mean, let's be honest, you know, most guys buying deals 4 years ago, they never would have projected that they would have been in a sub 4 cap market right now.
No.
So even if you're exiting at a 4.5 cap, you're doing pretty damn good when you sell, you know? And the other thing too, is that these guys that have had long-term fixed rate debt, their yield maintenance prepayment penalties are going down because the interest rates are going up. So, hey, they can take a little bit of a haircut because it's all kind of washing itself out, you know?
You know, Cody, nobody mentions that, and you're 100% right. What this does is it lowers those prepayment and yield maintenance penalties, which that helps the market, right? And then also, it makes assumptions come back, right? Someone who did lock in a low fixed rate a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, up until recently, no one would want to assume that loan because they want to get levered up and get their own low rate. Well, now it's like, oh, hey, wait, I can assume your 3 1/8 interest rate instead of get my own at 4.5. Okay, let's do that, right? So it cuts both ways. It both hurts and it helps.
Yeah, I completely agree, man. I completely agree. But look, to your point, as you've alluded to a couple times already, I think it's still a great time to be a buyer. There's still a lot of great opportunity to buy really good real estate. And, you know, with some of our competitors maybe sitting on the sideline, maybe pulling back and waiting to let the kind of dust settle, so to speak, because I think we're losing the predictability right now. And I think that's what's getting everybody unsettled is the volatility. And people would just say, hey, I want to let that calm down so we can get back to more predictability. But I think, man, there's still a great time, you know, to be active right now. So,
you know, that's a really good point. I may steal that from you. I'll give you credit the first two times, but that's what it is we've lost the certainty and the stability, whereas now we're in a little bit more uncertain and volatile market. And that's putting some people on the sidelines. But, you know, as long as you can account for those things, you really should be just fine.
Yep. We're going to sound like a broken record, right, Brian? But I mean, yeah. I think it's important to say, like, you know, Grant Cardone, he's told us this, and I just want to keep bringing it up because it's like, look, man, the most money that you've ever lost in real estate are the deals that you haven't bought, right? And so for people that are sitting on the sidelines right now, probably very similar to the same people that were sitting on the sidelines during COVID, that were sitting on the sidelines during the great financial crisis. Like, you know, I mean, listen, you just got to adjust to the market, keep your finger on the pulse and just be present. So, Andrew, so tell us, man, so what's on the horizon then for you guys that, you know, Q3, Q4 this year and what you guys are doing at Vantage?
Yeah, we actually just hired an analyst to add to our acquisitions team so that we can go even deeper in the same markets that we're in. We're interviewing for an investor relations person, and then hopefully maybe towards the end of the year, we'll add an asset manager. So we're in growth mode. Again, we're big believers long-term, and you know, we're excited about what we've done this year and what we're hopefully going to do here for the rest of the year. So.
Well, hey, man, it's excited to see the growth or hear the growth that you guys are achieving and the expansion. And so that's exciting. And congratulations to all your success thus far. Brian, anything for Andrew before we get into our final four here?
I really appreciate you coming on, Andrew, sharing some insight both for our active investors and our passive investors on what's going on in the market. I think there's lots of golden nuggets, people, to go back and listen to this one again, because we're talking real life here. We're not talking all the fluff. This is really what's going on. So definitely lots of good stuff.
Yeah, appreciate it.
I'm gonna definitely be going back and listen to this, Andrew. Hey, man. Well, we're gonna wrap up here with the final four questions, and then we'll give your time back. So, you know, one thing that we love to find out from all of our guests is, what do you like to do for your personal education to further your own investing?
My additional education these days is largely I listen to about 900 something podcasts a year. And then I try to maintain relationships with other people who do this in the market as much as possible. So I'm part of a large mastermind called GoBundance, which is not real estate focused, but you know, that's definitely a part of it. You know, I developed lots of awesome relationships through that. And then I'm part of other masterminds. And one of my favorite ones, it's not paid. It's just a group of 7 operators who've just kind of banded together. We meet once a month and we just talk and share, like, what are you struggling with? Hey, how would you solve this problem? So, you know, my ongoing education is, again, listen to tons of podcasts. I try to go to several events a year and actually meet and mingle with people and then stay in touch with other people that do this, because if you don't, it can be kind of a lonely endeavor. And also you'll be much more successful networking and talking with other people too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Andrew, looking at the course of your career, is there one moment of time or one event that changed the course of your trajectory?
Oh gosh, there's a lot of them, but one I would say that's probably relatable to most people is just taking the leap to go buy that first 92 unit. And candidly, there was a good chunk of naivety that helped do that. Didn't quite realize fully what we were getting into, but I'm glad we did, because I probably wouldn't be here talking to you if we hadn't. So even though it was big and scary and difficult and we didn't have all the answers as to exactly how we were going to do it, we did it anyway. And it was successful, and here we are. So.
Love it, man. Hey, School of Hard Knocks. That's the best way to learn. So get in it. So, well, that leads us right into the next question is, what advice would you give to the listeners to help them grow their businesses?
There's a lot, but gosh, we touched on a lot of it in our conversation today, just about, you know, relationship building and all of that. But I'll go back to let your yes be yes and no be no, meaning be reliable, be trustworthy, be honorable. And if you want a broker to trust you with the seller relationship that they've put time and energy and hard work into building, and they refer that seller to you, they're putting all of that work and effort and their reputation on the line. So be the person that they will be willing to trust with all of what I just said. And how you show people that you are that person is by consistently doing it day in and day out with all of the little things so that you get the opportunity to be trusted with the big things.
That is a bombshell. That's a nugget, man. That's a good one. Great way to end the show there, Andrew. So, hey, man, tell the listeners how they can learn more about you and get connected with you over at Vantage.
Yeah, probably the best way, just search Vantage Point Acquisitions. Our website comes up. It's vpacq.com. There's a variety of tabs on there to get in touch with me. Of course, I'm on BiggerPockets and LinkedIn. And maybe we can run into each other at a conference or two. So,
awesome. Andrew, it's been a fun conversation. Appreciate you joining us today. We look forward to staying connected.
All right. Take care, guys. Good talking with you.
Today's episode was proudly brought to you by Blue Oak Capital. To learn more about Blue Oak Capital and how you can partner with us, visit www.blueoakinvests.com. Tune in next time.